This is Radio EcoShock. Our next guest was the lead author of a team of reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their reporting on the Three Mile Island reactor accident in Pennsylvania on March 28, 1979, way back then, won a Pulitzer Prize. Susan has published in the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Fortune, Time Magazine, and Rolling Stone. She's now a freelance writer living in Maine. Susan Q. Stranahan is co-author of the new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Susan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Happy to be here.
Well, even though I followed nuclear affairs for too long, I don't want to admit how long, before Three Mile Island, I only learned after Fukushima that there really was a meltdown inside those reactors in Pennsylvania. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there was just the one reactor was affected by the accident, and yes, it was a partial meltdown, but I suppose a partial meltdown is like being partially pregnant. The sequence of events were so confusing initially. And it wasn't until considerably later when they were finally able to get in and examine the reactor to figure out how much damage that they discovered that, in fact, there had been a partial meltdown. So I'm sure that looking at Fukushima, there will be plenty of surprises of a similar or worse nature once they are able, assuming they are able, to get in and better calculate the extent of damage there.
Right. It wasn't until about 4 years later that they got cameras in at Three Mile Island. Is that right?
I think that's right. I'd have to go back and look at my notes. It has been a while.
Well, then it makes you wonder why it takes so long for this full story to come out. Even I didn't know it. And why most Americans still buy the original line that it was just a little release of radioactive steam that happened there in Three Mile Island.
I think part of it is that the public has a fairly short attention span. And so as details trickle out slowly, it's no longer on the front page. Some of the media in that part of Pennsylvania, of course, followed events very carefully. I mean, I was a member of the editorial board of the Inquirer during the 1980s, and a key issue was the restart of Unit 1. There was an enormous amount of opposition to that, believing that if they couldn't run Unit 2 safely, they couldn't be trusted to run Unit 1 safely. But the restart was eventually approved. And ironically, Unit 1 at Three Mile Island is the little engine that could. It's just a high-performing old reactor, but high-performing, a moneymaker for the owner, and there have been some safety issues there, but I think by and large the safety record is on average with other well-run reactors in the United States.
Who did own Three Mile Island?
Well, at the time of the accident, it was a very small local utility called Metropolitan Edison that had no nuclear operating experience, and it was a subsidiary of a larger utility called General Public Utilities that was based in New Jersey. But the Three Mile Island plant ended up on the Susquehanna River in central Pennsylvania, basically because there were some concerns about labor issues of building a reactor in New Jersey. So the Unit 2 reactor was built in Pennsylvania.
Why did you decide to help write the story of this triple meltdown in Fukushima, Japan, 3 years ago?
I have worked with Dave Lochbaum and the Union of Concerned Scientists for many, many years and have great respect for Dave, for Dave's technical knowledge, his ability to explain things, his careful adherence to good science and good engineering and not advocacy for advocacy's sake. What he says is based on fact. And that, as a reporter, is what you're looking for. And I have, over the years, an abiding interest in nuclear safety that grew out of my experience with Three Mile Island, and had written, coincidentally, a couple of pieces about nuclear safety at the time of the accident. And so when the Union of Concerned Scientists asked me to team up with Dave and with Ed Lyman, whom I didn't know nearly as well as Dave Lockbaum, I very quickly agreed. It seemed like a good partnership. And what I thought I could bring to this partnership is the ability to tell the story, to put a human face on the accident, to try to convey the intense drama that was unfolding there. This was a technological disaster, but it was also a very compelling human story.
I want to get more into that as we get going here, but first, I've tried to understand Japanese affairs for years. It's almost impossible for an outsider. How were you able to penetrate this strange relationship between the nuclear power operator, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, and the highest levels of the Japanese government?
We did not go to Japan. Ed went to Japan on a related matter, but did not get to Fukushima. But Dave and I were not in Japan, and we don't speak Japanese, so that was another real obstacle. We relied very heavily on documents that were from TEPCO, from the various post-accident investigations in Japan by a variety of committees and commissions. There was a great deal of material that was available in the public record from the United States, from the nuclear industry. So it was a massive research effort through available documents. The language barrier would have been prohibitive even if we had gone to Japan to do interviews, and while in a real ideal world that would have provided a lot of interesting information, we felt from the standpoint of being able to portray the accident and explain what happened, we could rely on public documents and tell the story that way.
Did TEPCO actually go broke because of Fukushima?
TEPCO had to get a bailout from the Japanese government, and let's make that clear, it's the Japanese taxpayers. I have not followed their bottom line recently, but no, I think they've recovered. Now, it's a lot like the United States in that the liability issue is very murky. And I certainly don't understand all of the nuclear liability provision in Japan, but I do think that TEPCO has been protected from the full cost of this accident by regulation and also by the government's willingness to come in and provide financial assistance to keep the company going. The big question is, who's going to pay for the staggering cost of the decontamination and the cleanup and the decommissioning? I mean, these are costs that could just skyrocket because no one's ever done this before.
Well, this is something that I think people who object to government debt and higher taxes, I'm thinking perhaps of even the Tea Party, they should really pay attention to these nuclear safety issues because, as far as I understand it, the American people are the insurance company for the nuclear industry. If you have a major accident in the United States, it's the taxpayer who's going to pay for that.
That's right, and we managed to kind of hide the real potential for liability, and I think you can make a case that because of this protection, the industry may not have adhered as much to safety and quality control as it might have. Dave Lockbaum makes an excellent point in that he says that if the owners of nuclear plants had to go out to State Farm or Nationwide and get an insurance policy, in all likelihood they would be a lot more attentive to upgrades and technical details to make the plant safer and safer and safer. But with this government protection under Price-Anderson, they realize that in the case of a severe accident, they are protected, and it's the American taxpayer who's going to foot the bill.
This is Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with Susan Stranahan and about her new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. So the other side of this story is all the people who lost their homes, some possibly forever. Can you tell us about the human impact in the area of Fukushima?
Yeah, and I think that that's the one thing that we can't lose sight of. The accident itself was an amazing sequence of heroism. When you think of the fact that many of the workers at Fukushima Daiichi labored for days on end, not knowing what had happened to their families, whether their homes had been destroyed, whether their villages had been washed away by this tsunami, and yet they stayed at their posts trying to wrestle these reactors into some safe condition, and is, sadly, time ran out. The communities around the nuclear plant, we write about how the world watched this accident unfold. We all saw it on our television screens and our cell phones and on our iPads. But because there was no power in this region, the people who were most closely affected and threatened couldn't see what was going on. So they really didn't know what was happening right down the road from them. And they would be relocated outside an evacuation zone with the assurance that they were out of harm's way. And then at some point someone would come in with radiation detection equipment and they'd be packed up and bundled off someplace else. So the communities around there had, many of these have been communities have been, their families have been living there for centuries, and they're no longer able to go back or may not want to go back because there are no services anymore. There's no assurance that a rainstorm or a forest fire won't recontaminate everything with radiation. One of the sad things that we write about is that there was a plume of radiation that blew to the northwest out about 35 to 40 miles from the plant. And at the time that the U.S. government was recommending that Americans in Japan evacuate out 50 miles from the reactor, the Japanese did not see that that was necessary. And so many people to the northwest of the plant remained in the plume for many, many days before ultimately they were told to leave. And so they were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation that the government just did not either identify or feel the need to move people out in a timely fashion.
And it's also about the kids, of course. They had children cleaning out swimming pools that had radioactive materials in them and cleaning up the landscape. And children now are at risk of leukemia and other health problems. And no doubt they learned a new level of fear that day. Does your new book on Fukushima look into that a bit?
We don't. There are so many aspects. The book could have been 900 pages long if we tried to cover a lot of this. And I think that the health consequences are an issue that that will play out over coming years and is ripe grounds for someone else who may come to this with a public health view. We did not deal with it. We dealt with more of the technical issues of what happened with the reactor, but also with the drama of the people who were trying at that moment to bring this reactor into a safe condition, and they couldn't. I think there'd be plenty of material for people to go back and do more.
Oh, I think there'll be a small library about it and lots of films, I hope, because there are so many angles to it, as you say. Now, look, at both Fukushima and Three Mile Island, the government's first reaction seems to have been to reassure people that everybody's perfectly safe, to downplay the danger. How would you compare the Japanese reaction to what happened after Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania?
Very eerily similar. The reaction at Three Mile Island was initially, we've been told by the company that there's no hazard here, and when in fact at the very moment the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania was saying that things were under control, the operators at TMI were venting radiation, not on the level of Fukushima, of course, but they were venting. So the initial reaction from both the public officials and the utility and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was to say things are safe, that there's no problem here. And you would certainly think that the 30-some years after Three Mile Island, public officials in Japan and elsewhere would learn that really the thing that people want to hear most is not some calming words, but the truth. And we write in the book that experts who've studied Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and now Fukushima all agree on one point, and that is that the public can handle the truth. The public wants the truth, and that if the public isn't given what it believes to be a straight story, then the cycle of fear and distrust begins to just build, and credibility is lost, and people don't know who to trust. And that was true at Three Mile Island. It was true at Fukushima. And it's really sad because at the moment when people are desperate, desperate for information, they just don't trust anybody.
So how would you describe your book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster? Can you take us through a little bit of how you approached it, how it develops in the book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. As a storyteller here, what I thought the best way to approach it was what newspaper people call a tick-tock, a minute-by-minute-by-minute account of what happened, and obviously with background and explanation. But what we do is we start with the chandeliers shaking in a hearing room in Tokyo in the Parliament building, and then the events that begin to sweep up. And so we tell this in a chronological fashion. We switch back and forth between what was happening in Japan in the government and at the reactor, and then back at what was happening at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the point of including the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is severalfold. Number one, they have a trove of amazing transcripts, chronological calls, emails, just a treasure trove of documents that enabled us to tell the story through the eyes and ears of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And certainly because it was in English, it helped us tell the story. But these are the people who are charged with protecting Americans. And the point that we made in the book is that this is not a Japanese nuclear accident. This is a nuclear accident that just happened to have occurred in Japan. It could very well have happened in the United States. So here we are telling a story about the best and the brightest of the nuclear safety experts in this country who are really at a loss as to what is happening, how to deal with it, what the ramifications are, how best to respond, what advice to give. So even though the events are 7,000 miles away in Japan, what's going on at the NRC is, we felt, very, very interesting and reflective of just the mindset that prevails in this industry, no matter where it is, that an accident like this couldn't happen, and therefore we don't need to plan for it and have a plan in our back pocket that would deal with an accident. It wouldn't have to be just an earthquake and a tsunami. It could be an earthquake. It could be a flood. It could be a terrorist attack. But there is no plan in place to address the issues that spilled out at Fukushima.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm betting most of our listeners don't know that just 1 year before Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission acquired a new building and hired 1,000 more people just to get ready for the promised nuclear renaissance. Where do you think that rebirth of nuclear power stands now after Fukushima?
Well, I think that there are several elements at play here. The availability of cheap natural gas has really changed the balance on energy in this country for a number of years. I do think a concern over climate change and the use of fossil fuels is going to keep nuclear as part of the energy mix. But what we say in this book is that if it is to be an active player in the energy mix, it has to improve its safety record. The public isn't going to accept the status quo. And that we've seen Three Mile Island, we've seen Fukushima. There has to now be pressure put on regulators and reactor owners to eliminate this mindset, get rid of this mindset, and recognize that the unexpected is possible and it has to be planned for. And that's the only way that the public is going to accept an expansion of nuclear power in the energy mix.
Yeah, well, I'm willing to bet there's a thousand angles to this story that I missed, and you're a seasoned reporter. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about this book or the Fukushima story?
One thing that intrigued me, and this is partly from my Pennsylvania experience and then watching this unfold, is that emergency planning is just inadequate, and that if the public were to focus on an easily understandable issue, they may not be able to go in and argue design and some of the more technical issues involving nuclear safety. But emergency planning is something they can get their head around. They can understand the need to have a clear-cut plan in place that is going to protect them and their families and their properties and their communities. And that seems to me to be where the public might have some leverage that they might not otherwise, if they were raising questions about nuclear safety that were purely a technological issue.
Our guest has been Susan Stranahan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on Three Mile Island and now co-author of one of the first books out of the gate on the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe in Japan. It is called Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. And I can guarantee from speaking to the authors that it's going to be a good and necessary read. Susan, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, I thank you for your time and your interest.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.